Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de la Comunidad Autónoma de Canarias. Pruebas de certificación de nivel intermedio B2 de inglés. Convocatoria de incidencias de 2021. Prueba de comprensión de textos orales. Esta parte consta de tres tareas. Escuchará cada grabación dos veces. Escuche y lea las instrucciones al principio de cada tarea y realícelas según se indica. Las respuestas escritas a lápiz o en tinta roja no se calificarán. No está permitido el uso del diccionario. El uso de cualquier dispositivo electrónico queda prohibido durante toda la prueba. El móvil tendrá que permanecer apagado y guardado. Escriba sus respuestas en la hoja de respuestas.
Task 1. You will hear 6 extracts from speeches delivered by famous people at universities. For each extract, 1 to 6, choose the heading that best matches the information you have heard. There are 3 headings you will not need to use. Extract 0 is given as an example. Write your answer in the answer sheet provided. Now you have 1 minute to read the questions. Example.
On this wonderful day when we are gathered together to celebrate your academic success, I have decided to talk to you about the benefits of failure. And as you stand on the threshold of what is sometimes called real life, I want to extol the crucial importance of imagination. These may seem quixotic or paradoxical choices, but bear with me.
Extract 1.
Our ambitions, our decisions, our responses are shaped by what we hold to be true. And for today, at least, I urge you to set aside your labels and explore what your principles say about the world you wish to serve. Because beliefs are our anchors. If they aren't, we run the risk of opportunism, making choices because others do so, not because we should. But those anchors should never weigh us down. They shouldn't weigh down our capacity for thoughtful engagement and reasonable compromise.
Extract 2.
When I was a child, my family was poor. No lawyer or judges lived in my neighborhood. I knew nothing about the Supreme Court or how it works, its work in interpreting the Constitution and the laws of the United States affects people's lives. You cannot dream of becoming something you do not know about. You have to learn to dream big. Education exposes you to what the world has to offer.
Extract 3.
On behalf of the 8 generations of my family who have been in this country, we're going to put a little fuel in your bus. Now, I've got the alumni over there, and this is a challenge to you, alumni. This is my class, 2019. And my family is making a grant to eliminate their student loans.
Extract 4.
You've got to find what you love, and that is as true for work as it is for your lovers.
Your work is going to fill a large part of your life, and the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking, and don't settle. As with all matters of the heart, you'll know when you find it. And like any great relationship, it just gets better and better as the years roll on. So keep looking. Don't settle.
Extract 5.
You here will all go on to achieve great things. There is no doubt about that. Each time you set out to do something new, your inexperience can either lead you down a path where you will conform to someone else's values, or you can forge your own path, even if you don't realize that's what you're doing. If your reasons are your own, your path, even if it's a strange and clumsy path, will be wholly yours, and you will control the rewards of what you do by making your internal life fulfilling.
Extract 6.
I can assure you that awards have very little bearing on my own personal happiness, my own sense of well-being and purpose in the world. That comes from studying the world feelingly, with empathy in my work. It comes from staying alert and alive and involved in the lives of the people that I love and the people in the wider world who need my help.
Listen again. Example.
On this wonderful day when we are gathered together to celebrate your academic success, I have decided to talk to you about the benefits of failure. And as you stand on the threshold of what is sometimes called real life, I want to extol the crucial importance of imagination. These may seem quixotic or paradoxical choices, but bear with me.
Extract 1.
Our ambitions, our decisions, our responses are shaped by what we hold to be true. And for today, at least, I urge you to set aside your labels and explore what your principles say about the world you wish to serve. Because beliefs are our anchors. If they aren't, we run the risk of opportunism, making choices because others do so, not because we should. But those anchors should never weigh us down. They shouldn't weigh down our capacity for thoughtful engagement and reasonable compromise.
Extract 2.
When I was a child, my family was poor. No lawyer or judges lived in my neighborhood. I knew nothing about the Supreme Court or how it works, its work in interpreting the Constitution and the laws of the United States affects people's lives. You cannot dream of becoming something you do not know about. You have to learn to dream big. Education exposes you to what the world has to offer.
Extract 3.
On behalf of the 8 generations of my family who have been in this country, we're going to put a little fuel in your bus. Now, I've got the alumni over there, and this is a challenge to you, alumni. This is my class, 2019. And my family is making a grant to eliminate their student loans.
Extract 4.
You've got to find what you love, and that is as true for work as it is for your lovers. Your work is going to fill a large part of your life, and the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking and don't settle. As with all matters of the heart, you'll know when you find it. And like any great relationship, it just gets better and better as the years roll on. So keep looking. Don't settle.
Extract 5.
You here will all go on to achieve great things. There is no doubt about that. Each time you set out to do something new, your inexperience can either lead you down a path where you will conform to someone else's values, or you can forge your own path, even if you don't realize that's what you're doing. If your reasons are your own, your path, even if it's a strange and clumsy path, will be wholly yours, and you will control the rewards of what you do by making your internal life fulfilling.
Extract 6.
I can assure you that awards have very little bearing on my own personal happiness, my own sense of well-being and purpose in the world. That comes from studying the world feelingly, with empathy in my work. It comes from staying alert and alive and involved in the lives of the people that I love and the people in the wider world who need my help.
This is the end of task 1. Now turn to task 2. Task 2. Listen to this news report about mercury in fish. Read the statements and mark them true or false according to what you hear. Sentence 0 is given as an example. Write your answers in the answer sheet provided. Now you have 1 minute to read the questions.
Now, eating fish can be beneficial to your health as long as the fish you choose isn't laced with contaminants such as mercury. The body can metabolize small amounts of mercury, but too much is toxic to the brain and nervous system, and children and fetuses are most vulnerable. For years, scientists have noticed that deep sea fish contain more mercury than fish from shallower waters. Now, a paper published in Nature Geoscience explains why different fish have different amounts of mercury. Joel Blum is a professor of geochemistry at the University of Michigan and co-author of the paper. Welcome to Living on Earth.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So your most recent study was about the toxic mercury found in fish. What did you notice about the different fish in your study?
Well, prior to this particular study, a colleague of mine had noticed that the deeper that fish lived in the ocean, the higher their concentrations of mercury were in their tissues. And so we wanted to understand why that was. And the study that we've just done was really focused on that problem.
So why is it that these fish have different amounts of mercury depending on how deep they swim in the ocean?
So the key to mercury, to understanding mercury, is that there are several different forms of mercury in the environment. And there's one form that is taken up into fish and that is most toxic, which is called methylmercury. And what we found in our study is that methylmercury is formed in the ocean at a variety of different depths in the ocean. But when it forms near the surface of the ocean, sunlight breaks down the methylmercury back to its common form and therefore essentially detoxifies it. But deeper in the ocean, where there is no sunlight, this process doesn't take place, and so the toxic form of mercury can build up and can be incorporated into the food web and ultimately into fish.
Where does the mercury in the fish come from?
In general, most of the mercury that's in the ocean came from the atmosphere and was deposited into the ocean in rainfall. And so the next question would be, why is there mercury in the atmosphere? And the main source of mercury to the atmosphere is the combustion of coal that we use to produce energy.
So most of the mercury in the atmosphere is not this toxic methyl mercury. How does it get that way?
The inorganic mercury that's in the atmosphere is processed by bacteria, which turn it into methylmercury. One of the things that we found in our study is that this processing or this methylation can happen in the open ocean, which we didn't previously realize.
How does the mercury affect the fish?
As far as we know, the mercury doesn't have a direct effect on the fish's behavior or health. At the levels that it's found in fish, it certainly can affect humans who eat the fish, but the fish themselves don't seem to be affected by the mercury.
And these are fish that you've done your research on that are fish that we're likely to eat, right?
Yeah, we looked at a whole range of fish. We looked at 9 different species of fish, and among those are several different types of tuna, swordfish, and a number of other commonly eaten fish from the Pacific Ocean.
You studied fish in the Pacific. How do the mercury levels in the Atlantic fish compare to that?
Well, they're similar. There's a recent study that compared mercury in the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean, and it seems that mercury in the Atlantic over time is actually decreasing somewhat, which is believed to be the effect of reduced emissions of mercury from North America, whereas mercury in the Pacific Ocean is on the increase due to increased emissions from the Asian continent.
And that would be burning of coal, then?
Exactly. That's the main source of mercury that's coming to the atmosphere from Asia.
So, by the way, Joel, from your research, which fish were the most loaded with mercury?
The fish that have the highest level that we studied are swordfish. And swordfish are top predators, and they also live deep in the ocean. And that kind of double whammy gives you the highest levels. And those are fish that one really has to consider how much they eat, because the exposure to mercury is really quite significant.
What do you hope comes out of this study, Joel?
Well, what we've really done is improved our understanding of the whole cycle of mercury, of how it gets into the marine environment, how it becomes toxic, and where it's taken up in the food chain. And so by having a better understanding of this process, you know, we hope that we can inform people about which fish should be avoided and which fish have lower levels of mercury and would be better choices for consumption.
Joel Bloom is a geochemistry professor at the University of Michigan who traces toxic metals through the environment. Joel, thanks for taking the time with me today.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
Listen again.
Now, eating fish can be beneficial to your health as long as the fish you choose isn't laced with contaminants, such as mercury. The body can metabolize small amounts of mercury, but too much is toxic to the brain and nervous system, and children and fetuses are most vulnerable. For years, scientists have noticed that deep-sea fish contain more mercury than fish from shallower waters. Now, a paper published in Nature Geoscience explains why different fish have different amounts of mercury. Joel Blum is a professor of geochemistry at the University of Michigan and co-author of the paper. Welcome to Living on Earth.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So your most recent study was about the toxic mercury found in fish. What did you notice about the different fish in your study?
Well, prior to this particular study, a colleague of mine had noticed that the deeper that fish lived in the ocean, the higher their concentrations of mercury were in their tissues. And so we wanted to understand why that was. And the study that we've just done was really focused on that problem.
So why is it that these fish have different amounts of mercury depending on how deep they swim in the ocean?
So the key to mercury, to understanding mercury, is that there are several different forms of mercury in the environment. And there's one form that is taken up into fish and that is most toxic, which is called methylmercury. And what we found in our study is that methylmercury is formed in the ocean at a variety of different depths in the ocean. But when it forms near the surface of the ocean, sunlight breaks down the methylmercury back to its common form and therefore essentially detoxifies it. But deeper in the ocean, where there is no sunlight, this process doesn't take place, and so the toxic form of mercury can build up and can be incorporated into the food web and ultimately into fish.
Where does the mercury in the fish come from?
In general, most of the mercury that's in the ocean came from the atmosphere and was deposited into the ocean in rainfall. And so the next question would be, why is there mercury in the atmosphere? And the main source of mercury to the atmosphere is the combustion of coal that we use to produce energy.
So most of the mercury in the atmosphere is not this toxic methyl mercury. How does it get that way?
The inorganic mercury that's in the atmosphere is processed by bacteria, which turn it into methyl mercury. One of the things that we found in our study is that this processing or this methylation can happen in the open ocean, which we didn't previously realize.
How does the mercury affect the fish?
As far as we know, the mercury doesn't have a direct effect on the fish's behavior or health. At the levels that it's found in fish, it certainly can affect humans who eat the fish, but the fish themselves don't seem to be affected by the mercury.
And these are fish that you've done your research on that are fish that we're likely to eat, right?
Yeah, we looked at a whole range of fish. We looked at 9 different species of fish, and among those are several different types of tuna, swordfish, and a number of other commonly eaten fish from the Pacific Ocean.
You studied fish in the Pacific. How do the mercury levels in the Atlantic fish compare to that?
Well, they're similar. There's a recent study that compared mercury in the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean, and it seems that mercury in the Atlantic over time is actually decreasing somewhat, which is believed to be the effect of reduced emissions of mercury from North America, whereas mercury in the Pacific Ocean is on the increase due to increased emissions from the Asian continent.
And that would be burning of coal then?
Exactly. That's the main source of mercury that's coming to the atmosphere from Asia.
So, by the way, Joel, from your research, which fish were the most loaded with mercury?
The fish that have the highest level that we studied are swordfish. And swordfish are top predators, and they also live deep in the ocean. And that kind of double whammy gives you the highest levels. And those are fish that one really has to consider how much they eat, because the exposure to mercury is really quite significant.
What do you hope comes out of this study, Joel?
Well, what we've really done is improved our understanding of the whole cycle of mercury, of how it gets into the marine environment, how it becomes toxic, and where it's taken up in the food chain. And so by having a better understanding of this process, you know, we hope that we can inform people about which fish should be avoided and which fish have lower levels of mercury and would be better choices for consumption.
Joel Blum is a geochemistry professor at the University of Michigan who traces toxic metals through the environment. Joel, thanks for taking the time with me today.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
This is the end of task 2. Now turn to task 3. Task 3. You will hear an interview with Alexandra Waldman talking about how her company, Universal Standard, started. For each question, choose the best option, A, B, or C, and write the corresponding letter in the white boxes. Item 0 is given as an example. Write your answers in the answer sheet provided. Now you have 2 minutes to read the questions.
You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Alex Waldman, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm very happy to be here.
So you are the co-founder and creative director of Universal Standard. Tell us a little bit about Universal Standard. What is it about?
Universal Standard is an apparel brand women's clothing that is kind of trying to create a paradigm shift in the fashion industry by desegregating plus size from regular size. So we really want to represent women in the United States as they are and to make sure that there is a size range that takes care of the very vast majority of women so that size is no longer part of the conversation.
So you started in 2015 with your co-founder, Polina Wexler.
That's right.
How did you two meet and what got you excited to start this concept?
Well, both of us had been living abroad for a very long time, and we moved coincidentally to New York about 2 months apart. We were connected by former friends and colleagues who knew that we were both in New York and didn't really know anyone. So we went for a drink and just became friends. That's how it all kind of started. There was a pivotal moment that we always tell the story of when we were supposed to go to an event, and I kind of pulled out at the last minute and said, I'm not going. And she said, why? And I said, I have nothing to wear, which seemed a very strange thing to her because, Pauline is a tiny girl and she has never been in a situation where not being able to buy clothing was an issue for her. So she was puzzled and she said, why don't we just go to the store and buy you something? And, you know, that's when I said, well, I can't. There isn't a single store on all of Fifth Avenue that I can walk into and buy clothes for myself. And, you know, the disbelief in her face was like, really? I mean, really? And I said, yeah. And I took her to a department store where I could shop. And we went past all these beautifully merchandised floors to the furniture floor, the northeast corner of the furniture floor, walked her right up to, you know, the astonishing array of polyesters and said, this corner right here is where I get to choose how to present myself to the world. And I think it was fascinating to her, something that I'd lived with all my adult life. So we started thinking about how to change that. Because obviously, once you started hearing statistics like 67% of American women are oversized 14, something wasn't making any sense. Like, how could a vast majority of American women be so underserved in a market that is constantly looking for opportunity and white space? So we started to really look into it and decided to launch Universal Standard to solve that problem.
And one of the things that you alluded to earlier is that you're not just trying to be for plus size women, but inclusive of all sizes. Is that one of the aspects that you think sets apart the way that you're approaching the market?
Well, I think it actually goes beyond that, because I think that's the default thinking, which is very reasonable because that's how things have always been. What we wanted to do is actually do the largest size range in the world, so that we didn't have to talk about size. Ironically, as soon as people hear that you are also making sizes that go beyond a size 14, they tend to think of you as a plus size brand. We are not a plus size brand. I suppose you could call us a size inclusive brand, but we're hoping to create a world where neither of those descriptions is necessary, where they're both completely obsolete. So it's just clothing for women. And we go from a size 00 to a size 40, and that's an American 40, not a European 40. So it's a vast range of sizes, because we want women to be able to walk into a store and then just ask themselves, like, do I like this? Is this my style? Rather than, does this come in my size, or not even enter the store because they know it doesn't.
Yeah. And I imagine there's all kinds of logistical reasons that this it has got to be like a huge challenge, just keeping all of those different sizes in inventory and the cash flow around that. And creatively, I know as you know, as the creative director, just from a photography standpoint, it must be really challenging. And so I'm guessing some of those are some of the reasons maybe the industry hasn't gone in a more inclusive direction already. But what are the main things you think that have created that limitation in the past?
You know, this is the question that everyone's asking, and it's actually fascinating because the answer is quite unsavory. The biggest obstacle to size inclusivity being the norm is a very ingrained, calcified prejudice against big bodies. I would say that is the sort of the biggest start of the problem. For decades and decades, we have seen smaller bodies as the ideal and larger bodies as something unwanted. So to change that mind.
Listen again.
You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Alex Waldman, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm very happy to be here.
So you are the co-founder and creative director of Universal Standard. Tell us a little bit about Universal Standard. What is it about?
Universal Standard is an apparel brand of women's clothing that is kind of trying to create a paradigm shift in the fashion industry. by desegregating plus size from regular size. So we really want to represent women in the United States as they are, and to make sure that there is a size range that takes care of the very vast majority of women, so that size is no longer part of the conversation.
So you started in 2015 with your co-founder, Polina Wexler.
That's right.
How did you two meet, and what got you excited to start this concept?
Well, both of us had been living abroad for a very long time, and we moved coincidentally to New York about 2 months apart. We were connected by former friends and colleagues who knew that we were both in New York and didn't really know anyone. So we went for a drink and just became friends. That's how it all kind of started. There was a pivotal moment that we always tell the story of when we were supposed to go to an event. And I kind of pulled out at the last minute and said, I'm not going. And she said, why? And I said, I have nothing to wear, which seemed a very strange thing to her because, you know, Pauline is a tiny girl and she has never been in a situation where not being able to buy clothing was an issue for her. So she was puzzled and she said, why don't we just go to the store and buy you something? And, you know, that's when I said, well, I can't. There isn't a single store on all of Fifth Avenue that I can walk into and buy clothes for myself. And, you know, the disbelief in her face was like, really? I mean, really? And I said, yeah. And I took her to a department store where I could shop. And we went past all these beautifully merchandised floors to the furniture floor, the northeast corner of the furniture floor, walked her right up to, you know, the astonishing array of polyesters and said, this corner right here is where I get to choose how to present myself to the world. And I think it was fascinating to her, something that I'd lived with all my adult life. So we started thinking about how to change that. Because obviously, once you started hearing statistics like 67% of American women are over size 14, something wasn't making any sense. Like, how could a vast majority of American women be so underserved in a market that is constantly looking for opportunity and white space? So we started to really look into it and decided to launch Universal Standard to solve that problem.
And one of the things that you alluded to earlier is that you're not just trying to be for plus size women, but inclusive of all sizes. Is that one of the aspects that you think sets apart the way that you're approaching the market?
Well, I think it actually goes beyond that, because I think that's the default thinking, which is very reasonable because that's how things have always been. What we wanted to do is actually do the largest size range in the world so that we didn't have to talk about size. Ironically, as soon as people hear that you are also making sizes that go beyond a size 14, they tend to think of you as a plus size brand. We are not a plus size brand. I suppose you could call us a size inclusive brand, but we're hoping to create a world where neither of those descriptions is necessary, where they're both completely obsolete. So it's just clothing for women. And we go from a size 00 to a size 40, and that's an American 40, not a European 40. So it's a vast range of sizes, because we want women to be able to walk into a store and then just ask themselves, like, do I like this? Is this my style? Rather than, does this come in my size? Or not even enter the store because they know it doesn't.
Yeah. And I imagine there's all kinds of logistical reasons that this it has got to be like a huge challenge, just keeping all of those different sizes in inventory and the cash flow around that. And creatively, I know as, you know, as the creative director, just from a photography standpoint, it must be really challenging. And so I'm guessing some of those are some of the reasons maybe the industry hasn't gone in a more inclusive direction already. But what are the main things you think that have created that limitation in the past?
You know, this is the question that everyone's asking, and it's actually fascinating because the answer is quite unsavory. The biggest obstacle to size inclusivity being the norm is a very ingrained, calcified prejudice against big bodies. I would say that that is the sort of the biggest start of the problem. For decades and decades, we have seen smaller bodies as the ideal and larger bodies as something unwanted. So to change that mind.
This is the end of task 3. Now you have 3 minutes to write your answers in the answer sheet. This is the end of the listening test.